Welcome to the Weekly Radio Spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Diane Farsetta. In our top spin, listeners who heard the Prozac Nation Revisited program on public radio stations were probably relieved to hear medical experts downplay the link between antidepressants and suicide. But they might have been less convinced if they were aware of the many connections between the show and pharmaceutical companies. All four of the medical experts featured in the program have ties to the drug industry. One guest is a PR executive whose firm flacks for more than a dozen drug makers, including Eli Lilly, the maker of Prozac. The series that produced the segment also receives grants from Eli Lilly.
As previously reported on the Weekly Radio Spin, the Heartland Institute works hard to prevent progress on the issue of climate change. The ExxonMobil-funded think tank has now turned its attention north of the border. In an attempt to influence Canadian school children, the global warming skeptics mailed DVDs and brochures to thousands of schools in every Canadian province. The Heartland DVD says that scientists are deeply divided on the role of human activity in global warming and that politics are overshadowing science. Here's a clip.
All of these theories are being explored by scientists to fully understand the complex factors that influence climate. However, the current political landscape endorses just one theory, that human-generated CO2 is the principal cause of global warming.
Those views are indeed promoted by political bodies, which is the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change.
Environmentalists are concerned by this effort by Heartland. The Sierra Club of Canada said, quote, "It's alarming that an American think tank is distributing misinformation on the most important issue of our time in Canadian schools, to actually create an illusion that there is a scientific debate," end quote.
A top official with the Environmental Protection Agency says that she's being forced out of a job. She claims that because she exerted pressure on Dow Chemical to clean up dioxin contamination in her Midwest region, she was told to either quit or be fired. Other EPA sources praise Dow's cleanup efforts. The company has addressed some highly contaminated spots, but there's no timeline for the full cleanup project. Dow denies any role in the EPA official's departure. Environmentalists fear that the forced resignation will let polluters off the hook and will lead government regulators to conclude that going easy on industry equals job security. The Office of Representative Charles Dingell of Michigan is investigating the EPA official's complaint.
It's unusual that meat producers, the Humane Society of the United States, and Congress members would all be on the same side of an issue. But that's the case regarding regulation of downer cows in the human food supply. Downer cows are those too sick or hurt to stand for slaughter. Major industry groups recently reversed their position to join others in calling for an absolute ban. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture is not rushing to implement the appropriate regulations. Despite such an overwhelming consensus, a spokesperson for U.S. Agriculture Secretary Ed Schaefer said while the issue is considered serious, quote, "there's no position being taken right now," end quote. One concern about downer cows in the food supply is that they have a higher risk of passing mad cow disease on to consumers.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Fakin, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned Dow Chemical and its pollution of Midwestern waterways. The chemical in question, dioxin, is one of the most dangerous substances. Dioxin causes a host of problems, including cancer, miscarriage, and birth defects. But Dow's chemical legacy spreads much farther afield than its home state of Michigan. During the Vietnam War, Dow produced the defoliant napalm for the U.S. military. Napalm burns on the bodies of fleeing Vietnamese civilians have been well documented. And dioxin, produced by Dow and other chemical companies, was a main ingredient of Agent Orange. In addition, one subsidiary of Dow is Union Carbide. Union Carbide was responsible for the 1980s industrial disaster in Bhopal, India, which killed thousands of people and continues to poison the area. In the first half of last year alone, Dow spent over $2 million lobbying Congress.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
And we're back with Indie Media on Air. Our next piece comes from the podcast, The Kamala Bhatt Show. Kamala recently spoke to Lal David Rai, a California farmer of Punjabi and Mexican descent, who farms in the Yuba City area, up north in Sutter County. With food prices rising and shortages of beginning to appear, it might be a good time to listen in and find out what farmers are thinking.
This is Kamala Bhatt.
I'm talking to Lal David Rai, who is a farmer in Yuba City in Sutter County. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you.
David, what do you think of this food crisis? You know, every day when I watch TV, all I see is that there's rice rationing that's going to happen and food shortage. As a farmer, what do you see? Is it rice? Is there a real dearth of...
A shortage of rice?
Yeah.
No.
Where is this coming from then, this frenzy?
I think people panicking. And a lot of the people... The American people only eat an average of 20 pounds of rice per year. The Asians eat like 120 pounds of rice.
Now, you are a Punjabi Mexican. How many pounds of rice do you reckon you eat?
Oh, about 11 and a half.
Okay. So the average consumption is very low.
Correct.
That's the point you're making. And you're saying that there's enough rice available for people in this country.
True, yes. What you're hearing about the rationing, like you hear at Costco and Sam's, it's long grain and basmati, and mainly the rice in California is medium grain.
Okay. So these are imported rice?
Mainly the basmati is, the long grain is from the south, Mississippi, mm-hmm. Arkansas, and that area. But there's plenty of rice. I think the Asians, because there's so many of the Vietnamese, the Indians, and... I think they're just stockpiling, hoarding it.
But is there a food crisis?
There is and there isn't. Depends on what food, like corn, there is. Because so many people are raising corn where they used to feed cattle with them, with corn.
Hmm.
Today, it's going for ethanol.
Hmm.
So there's a shortage of corn. And the dairy farmers cannot afford to pay the higher prices for corn. So a lot of them are selling their cattle.
Hmm.
So corn, the grain prices are like wheat and stuff, that's an all-time high. There is a shortage, and then I was hearing like, was it India has stopped exporting? So that'll all... drive the price up.
Why do you think there's a food shortage? I mean, it seems kind of strange to hear that there's food shortage in this time of technology where there's a lot of plenty of food.
Well, a lot of it has to do with weather conditions too, all over the world. Australia's in a drought. They've been in a drought for 6 years. The weather conditions all over the world isn't perfect. You hear so much about global warming.
At a local level, do you think global warming has impacted you?
I don't really know. I know the springs here have been drier than normal. I ran into this friend of mine that I hadn't seen in 30 years. Ran into him this last summer at a funeral. And this guy is 6'6". You'd ever visualize a Texan. This guy looked like him. And he's been up in Alaska working for Conoco Oil. And I went up to him and I says, "Larry, you remember me?" And he looked at me and he says, "Yeah, how you been?" And so we started talking and I asked him, I says, "Larry, I see, you know, you hear about global warming. Do you see any of it up there?" And he stopped and looked at me and hesitated and said, "The little town that I'm in had a glacier right there." He said, "You could pick up a stone and hit it." And he said, "Today you'd have to get in a boat and travel half a mile."
The glacier has receded.
Yes, melting. So, I'm assuming there is, but you know, we're hearing, we don't know how many times the Earth has gone through this before.
Hmm.
Everybody thinks it's pollution and stuff like that. We don't know.
But as a farmer, what are you concerned about when you hear that there is food crisis and food shortage in the world?
Plant the right crop.
What is it?
Well, the right crop?
Mm-hmm.
Well, right now it's any grains.
Hmm. And how do you know what is the right crop?
Because with our economy the way it is, people are going to eat the bare essentials.
Hmm.
The Indian people want their rotis and their dals and stuff like that. The Chinese Orientals will eat rice and stuff like that. People are going to, they're not going to eat desserts like the peaches and the fruits and stuff like that. They're going to want what they need. And those are the crops to plant.
So how can you make the change here in Yuba City, which is traditionally grown orchard kind of, you know, fruits?
Well, there you're kind of stuck. You have to stay in that mode.
Why?
Because it takes a lot of capital to change. And then not only that, but the orchard sizes are a lot smaller compared to the sizes of tracts that are grains growing on. You need a lot more acreage, bigger acreage.
As a farmer, how are you planning your next 2 to 3 years?
Well, I have tenants.
Hmm.
And I, if my tenants don't do well, I don't do well.
Hmm.
I'm very lucky. I have excellent tenants. But what's really an issue is water in California.
Even here in Yuba City?
Absolutely, here in Yuba City. It's bigger. It's going to impact everybody.
How come? Because I hear that Yuba City has got 5 rivers around it.
That's true. The 5 rivers, well, actually there's 3.
Hmm.
You're thinking of Punjab.
Well, I've been told that Yuba City has 5 rivers.
Well, no, there's the Feather, there's the Yuba, there's the Bear, and the Sacramento.
4. And I don't know what the 5th is.
Yeah,
maybe some Punjabi made it up.
Well, I think he's talking about Punjab.
No.
Doesn't Punjab mean 5 rivers?
Yes. Yeah.
See, here there's 4.
But, to get back to the point, even with 4 rivers, is there a problem?
Well, usually when there's 4 rivers, I mean, just because there's water in the river doesn't mean you're entitled to that water.
Oh, how does it work?
Well, water rights. The cities all pump water,
uh-huh.
And look how many cities there is around here.
Uh-huh.
Then there is the farmers, and then they need a certain amount of water to maintain the rivers so the fish will have water. And then in San Francisco, coming up through Vallejo and the Carquinez Strait, the salt intrusion's coming in.
Uh-huh.
They need a certain amount of fresh water flowing to keep that salt out from flowing up the river. So there has to be water releases to keep the salt out, plus enough for the fish.
So as a consumer, as somebody, you know, who's listening to you, what do you think I can do to make this a better world?
In which way?
My food habits, I don't know. I mean,
your food habits? Eat stuff that's grown in the United States. That'll help us here. Now, health-wise, they say nuts, fruits, fresh vegetables.
Do you think there's a lot of education that needs to be done about food and nutrition and what is the right kind of food that we need to eat?
Yes and no. I was brought up that way. But then you hear there was a person in England that was 106 years old, 107 years old, didn't drink any water. All he drank was beer. He smoked cigarettes, and he was a laborer. He washed cars. Mm. And at 106, he's still washing cars. I don't know. I think a lot of it is hereditary.
You come from a farming family, you know, 3 generations. You're the 3rd generation farmer. What is the difference that you see today when you look back and look at, say, 50, 60 years ago when you started farming? And then you look at the state of farming today. What are the major differences that you see?
I see more technology. I see bigger yields in our crops. I see less pesticide usage. I see labor problems, water problems. I see air problems.
Do you see anything that's positive?
Well, people always got to eat. There was a movie when I remember about 30 years ago with Charlton Heston, Soylent Green. And everybody was eating these little green tablets. And nobody ate any food. All they'd have were these green tablets. So he wanted to investigate where these green tablets were. And it was the people that had died that shred their bodies and made these tablets. So I hope it doesn't come to that.
People. I sure hope not. David, it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
You were listening to Lal David Rai, who is a second-generation farmer of Mexican, Punjabi, and American heritage who lives in Yuba City in Sutter County. Sutter County is located in Northern California. This is Kamla Bhatt, and as always, thank you for tuning in.
You're listening to Indie Media on Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. Finally, we head back south to Ontario, California. Back in March, the City of Ontario evicted residents of a city-sanctioned homeless camp near the Ontario Airport. The tent city's population had grown to about 500 since it opened last year. Officials are limiting access now, and only homeless people who can prove they once lived in Ontario are permitted to stay. Days after the evictions took place, the LA Independent Media Center spoke to homeless rights activist Mike Dunlap, who tells the history of how the tent city developed.
My name's Mike Dunlap with Homeless We Care. I'm a homeless advocate.
And you're involved in the campaign to help people that are currently camped out in Ontario at the tent city?
That's correct, uh-huh.
And can you tell me a little bit about how this came to be and what's going on?
Back in July, and actually June before that, I was feeding in the area Ontario Valley, and one night I came up, my regular feeding, and we give out clothes and different things to people that are on the street, anything that they would need as far as a change of clothes, as far as food, as far as socks, shoes, socks, change pants, jackets, sleeping bags, whatever. But we'd come up, and I wasn't aware where we were at, but what had happened is they had about 25 to 35 people at the museum in Ontario, which is right adjacent to the train station where the train goes through, and apparently it had been growing, and they were afraid that somebody was going to be drunk and fall in front of a train. So I think it was July 4th or July 5th I came that night to feed, and then there was only three people. And I guess that same day somebody said they were in an article that the police had come on over in the city and asked them to go to move over to this area, which is where they are presently. So what they did, the city, I guess, had a redevelopment area where they had leveled off all the homes, and it was available right next adjacent to the airport. So they brought some water out there. They made a small little area, put, like, wood chips down to try to make it somewhat nice, gave them a latrine, and gave them a trash can. And that's where it started, and then they were in the paver. We started feeding out there. Different churches, organizations came out from being in the paper, just asked what they could do and help. So we all sort of just did it one day at a time as far as slightly organizing, trying to see if we could make sure that we're still feeding them on a regular basis and stuff like that. At that time, we built a temporary outdoor-type shower because it was July and it was hot. And just something where you could turn the water in on basically a faucet that, you know, you could stand underneath instead of the hose bib that they had out there. And from there it grew. My thinking was that, you know what, the city sort of moved them, and what usually happens is all the other places, they're going to disperse it after it after it's been there for a little while since they're out of sight. And since they were in the paper and they didn't, it doubled in size. Got up to like 50 people right away, and then got up to around 80 to 100 people within the first month. We had more and more people coming from the outside trying to help, different churches, and so it it was getting too big to really do anything as far as the city dispersing it. And then we had a windstorm, a 70-mile-an-hour windstorm, that went through there, destroyed about 50 tents, and that's where I called one of the reporters from Daily Bulletin, and she got us in there and said, please help, we need tents, we need camping equipment. 70-mile-an-hour winds went through the encampment, and they came out and took some pictures and stuff, and from there on it basically grew. And then we had the Boy Scouts, we had the Red Cross, we had a bunch of different people that were donating stuff so that we could get them, try to help them in any way we could. And we also started one gentleman from a large organization donated a shower, which was where you can heat it up on the premises out of a propane tank. And then so we've started bringing out hot showers, and that was one of the things when I was on the streets years ago that you needed for two reasons. One, because once a week you need a real good shower, and the other thing, when it's warm water, it takes the stress out of your body. And when you live on the streets, there's a lot of stress. And so from there, it just kept going and growing. At about 2 months, we were in contact with the city and whoever would be in charge out there, and started to try to formulate a plan of what would work the best for the people that are out there that would not cost the city a lot of money. We were still hoping that they would turn it into a full-time park type atmosphere. And we didn't get too much response. They weren't really interested. Everything that we ever tried to do out there, in the beginning they would listen, but later down the road they wouldn't even give us an avenue to talk. But everything we had was on a volunteer base. We had enough funding from the people, the churches, and the volunteers to go ahead and come in. We had a lot of people that were going to donate trailers, office trailers, those C boxes, so we could get out there to put all the donations in. Just about anything we needed would have been free, and we could have had a volunteer base to run the whole camp. And we were hoping that we'd be able to set it up as far as treat it like a disaster. And then from that, we'd have everybody, the county, everybody, city, everybody that would come to the site one day a week, and then interview the people and start working them out, just as they do with Red Cross when they have disasters.
Right.
And then use it pretty much as a workable plan that we could take across the other cities.
Now, my understanding is that the city this is city-owned property, right?
Yeah, that
was...
Well, that was the biggest problem of all, and we understood that because we looked at both sides of anything when we had our meetings and trying to see how we could work with them. But really it is because of the liability, and so I understand why they couldn't allow us out in the beginning, and they didn't want to, and I guess they took it upon themselves to work out some type of a plan, which sort of, speeds it up a little bit, brings it out to present day. And we got to go back just a little bit, and what it is all the problems that they started to get once the public knew they were there were caused a lot of from the outside people coming in, and one even donating, because there was such a flood of clothes and food and everything else. What it did is the homeless usually would go out during the day and scavenge and do whatever to survive, and they'd come there at night. Well, what happened from that, and everybody coming out giving them, they just stayed there. And then more and more people were dumping stuff off, and they didn't ever have to go do the worst because they just get more clothes donated. And what happened is it turned it into a trash pile. They'd go through the bag and then just leave it because there were no central locations. There was no order to anything. Anybody from the outside was allowed to come in. And then the same thing, it also turned into a lot of drinking and a lot of drug use, which brought the gangs in, which brought the prostitution in. And it was sort of a lack of supervision, because they were just, I think they may have just been afraid of coming out there and causing problems because they're homeless. But that doesn't make sense, because if the homeless are anywhere else in the city, if something's going on that's not right, the police confront them. But it really turned into a hands-off policy from my point of view, and being out there all the time.
From the police.
Yeah, and they'll say, no, it isn't, but I was out there, and it sort of ended up being that way, which allow the people from the outside now, instead of staying in hotels and partying, they could come out to the encampment and stay 3, 4, 5 days. It didn't cost them anything. They'd get a chance to stay with friends and just party all the time. So if we could have gone in there and controlled it in the beginning, this never would have happened. It would have been clean. It would have been proper. It would have been a place for somebody to come, if they're on the street, where they could come in, have a safe place to sleep, somebody that'd be able to go out during the day. We would get them somehow one meal a night at least, and or we would give them the information, and it would be a possibly a job center there as far as outside people coming in that have part-time jobs or something. And like I say, it could have been done a lot different, and I'm hoping that anything ever opens up would allow the at least the communication of that. What I was thinking also, it'd be a good idea if they had people that used to live on the streets have some type of a council where they would be able to sit down with the city with open communication and say, you know, from our experience, this is what we've learned. And that's what we were trying to bring to them. But it's hard to tell one person the experiences about when you lived on the street and how the psychology of homeless are and the mental illness and everything else that they're dealing with it, because they've never experienced it. So whatever city or county needs to have some type of a board made up of people that have been on the streets for a period of time that have gone through that process to go ahead and help them.
That was Mike Dunlap, homeless rights activist, talking to the LA Independent Media Center about the tent city in Ontario. For links to the full interview and links to all the pieces you heard today, click over to the Indie Media On Air program page at kpfk.org. My thanks to LA Indie Media, to Kamala Bhatt, Georgia Popplewell, and Firoz Manji, who created all the great pieces you heard today. I'm Bronwyn Malden with the Los Angeles Independent Media Center. If you'd like to comment on the show, drop me a line at radioinc@gmail.com. Join us again next week and every Monday at 3 p.m. for Indie Media On Air on KPFK. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and streaming worldwide at kpfk.org.